Cantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Duke and the Dressmaker by Eva Devon, narrated by Sasha Higgins. Chapter 1. If another young woman stuffed a hairpin in his pocket, accidentally dropped a jewel before him, or allowed a handkerchief to flutter in front of his boots, James Blakefield, the new Duke of Ashbridge, was going to go mad. Quite frankly, he'd had enough. The machinations of the English aristocracy were a thing to behold. He was fairly certain that if the mamas of the ton had been put in charge of the English army during the Revolution, the Americans never would have had a chance, and that was saying something. James had been chased, cornered, and manipulated by those infernal mamas. The attempts to get him into a private room or behind a hedgerow was shocking, and he was not easily shocked. Sea captains seldom were. Now, granted, he was not a usual sea captain. After all, he had been born in Boston not long after the Revolution. He had a host of ships and sailed the world, running his company. But an inheritance had come, an English dukedom. It astonished him, but he had not turned it down. Turning such power down would be sheer foolishness. London had called, and he had come, whereupon he had discovered that the running of the vast estates of a dukedom was, for all intents and purposes, similar to running a large company, or a small country. But the darkest part of the entire thing was the way in which every single English mamma seemed certain that he was in want of a wife. He was not in want of a wife. He had no desire to marry. He'd seen the way marriage could ruin people, and he had no desire to add to the misery of another person by marrying them. Still, attendance of balls was necessary. He was trying to garner support for his goals in London. One, to open a shipping office here, and two, to go, if not to war, then at least into opposition with the East India Company and its blood-stained hands. That beast of a company controlled most of the seas and far too many lands. It needed to be restricted, and as a duke, he had some power and the ability to say what should and should not be done with it. He could have sway if he wished it, but only if he attended events such as these blasted balls. The Earl of Derby smirked at him.
"You look as if you're drowning."
"I am drowning," he agreed,
"in lace, perfume, and ridiculous chatter."
"It's not so very terrible," Derby said unconvincingly. James snorted.
"Then why don't I see you out there on the dance floor?"
"Because the right ladies have not shown up yet. I don't dance with debutantes."
"No?"
He arched a brow. Derby shuddered.
"No, I have no wish to marry at present. The mamas know this. I'm only here as your friend and ally to guide you through the storms of society."
"Very good of you," James drawled.
"Isn't it?"
Derby replied, his lips twitching. Their fathers had been friends years ago, and the previous Earl of Derby had been on the side of the Americans in the American Revolution, urging Parliament to simply let the colonies go. Of course, that had not occurred. Derby now was a supporter of philosophers, writers, and artists. One wouldn't know it by looking, though. He seemed a rake to almost everyone. Still, Derby was a good sort, and one of the only English people James could tolerate. The ton was full of rules. Stuffy, impossible rules, like how many times he could dance with someone, who was to enter a room first, and how, who could sit where at a table, and who was to speak and have precedence. The rules were similar to those on a sailing ship, only there was really no purpose to them except to maintain a sense of control. Now, that was also why there were rules on a sailing ship, but the control on a ship was to make certain that the ship reached its destination. The rules in the ton were simply to ensure that no one left their place, and James did not approve of such a thing.
He was just about to say so to Darby when a bevy of mamas rushed at him.
"Good God, they've spotted me," he groaned.
"Indeed they have," Darby said with undisguised amusement. "I'm tempted to let them have at you."
He piped a sound of dismay.
"We have already been here for 2 hours. I have danced with 15 young ladies, made compliments about their hair, their clothes, and have talked about spaniels more than I ever knew was possible."
"You request rescue, then?" Darby said.
He blurted out another note of dismay.
"Right," Darby said. "I know a place. Let's go."
There was a cry of alarm as he and Darby whirled from the ballroom and headed out into the cool hall.
"Your Grace! Your Grace!" they called in chorus. "You cannot possibly be leaving," another called.
He turned and clasped his hands behind his back, unwilling to be deliberately rude, even though he wished to be. Lady Barlow smiled at him and battered her fan.
"My daughter Calliope would adore the opportunity to converse with you, Your Grace."
"I have conversed with Calliope," he ventured as politely as he could, given the way in which Calliope had cornered him earlier this evening.
"While she knows a great deal about botany, and I admire her admiration of the tulip, I find I must depart."
Her mother beamed.
"You simply must visit us tomorrow, Your Grace, and she can show you her collection. Each bulb is worth a fortune."
He gave a quick bow, turned, and headed off with Darby.
"Is that to be the extent of a duke's life?" he said under his breath, "making polite conversation over tulip bulbs."
Darby laughed, then mocked.
"It's a hard life."
"Fine," he said. "I realize it is the price one pays for power. Now, take me wherever the hell you want to take me. Anything would be better than this."
James gazed about the barroom of the Maiden's Jig Tavern and sighed in relief. It wasn't that he didn't know what to do in a ballroom, but unlike the people here laughing and chatting merrily, ton conversation was ridiculous, venturing on painful. They restricted themselves to dogs, the weather, and the races. And tulips. He mustn't forget tulips. Unlike those who ruled this isle, he was going to settle his business in this town and get out before they could pull him into their web. In 6 weeks, he'd be gone. Still, as he gazed around the London tavern, the scene was a wonder. The occupants who were crushed in on benches and chairs about rough tables had clearly not washed in days. Not a single one of them had access to good water. Frankly, he was surprised that most of them had not dropped dead with disease from the state of their part of town. There were bugs everywhere. Cats, lamp-eyed, fearsome creatures, chased rats. Said rats gnawed upon the bones left on the floor, and dogs were everywhere, sleeping at the feet of their masters both inside and out. This was life at its most raw. A fiddler and button accordion player sat in the corner of the room, playing a lively reel. Several men and women in ill-fitting but colourful garb were up dancing about together, whirling and twirling around better than any sailor doing the hornpipe. James looked to the Earl of Derby, who easily downed half a glass of gin.
"Bloody hell!" the Earl said merrily. "This stuff will burn a hole through a man's esophagus. Isn't it marvellous?"
Darby took down another drink, his blue eyes flashing with glee and horror at once. Truthfully, James liked the clear liquid. It burned, and he needed a good burn because if he was going to face the next few weeks, well, this would at least take some of the tension off after surviving hours in the mind-dulling company of the ton. And then there was the damned important, but also damned annoying fact he had to find a girl. A girl, of all things. Not just any girl. His ward. His men had been tracking down her whereabouts. The most recent report had found she lived in this part of town, but they had yet to seize upon the exact location. They'd know soon.
There was a rumour she lived above a Frenchwoman's dress shop, and there were only so many of those around. Once she was found, James would fetch her himself. Nothing was well done if one did not do it themselves, or at least oversee the matter, and he did not trust any man to take care of his ward. A ward, for God's sake! How had he inherited a ward and a title? He was not entirely sure. He'd need pins, string, and a complex point-by-point explanation of the family tree to understand how an American sailor was now an English duke. He leaned back on the rough-hewn board that doubled as a chair, sprawling his arm out. The fact that the girl lived near this hellhole made him wonder how the devil his ward had been put in such circumstances. It did seem as if his predecessor, the old Duke of Ashbridge, had been a bit of an ass. More than a bit. He'd been a cruel bastard. From what he'd gathered from the old Duke's unpleasant butler, Davidson, the Duke had kicked out his own daughter, making her flee to Europe with the love of her life. And when the two of them had kicked off in Paris, the then-Duke had abandoned his daughter's children. James couldn't imagine it. Well, that wasn't quite right. He could imagine being abandoned, but not like that. Not because someone wasn't damned fancy enough. James had clawed and fought to survive, alone after first his father's and then his mother's death. He knew the pain of having no parents and being adrift in a world that ate children up as if they were chocolates. No, he would not think of it tonight. If he did, he'd down the entire bottle of gin, and that would do him no favours. He needed to have his wits about him. A new ship was going to be launched in Boston in 10 weeks, and he'd be there. His business in London would be done in 6 weeks, which allowed a month for the crossing. He was always there when a new ship of his line took to the sea. They were the only children he'd ever had, or ever wanted. And then there was the fact his father had hated London. But tonight, he was damned glad Darby had brought him here for a bit of freedom. He needed it. The sort of freedom he experienced on his ship, the Dauntless. But this part of town was not like a ship. There was no order. There were no rules, and as he swung his gaze around, he realised that a fight could break out at any moment. He felt on edge, ready for anything. Darby seemed to sense it. The man winked at him and waved a barmaid over. The young woman's dark brown hair was billowing about a heart-shaped face as she swung her full tray up onto a barely covered shoulder. Her linen bodice was low, and her tightly cinched waist only emphasised her curves. Still, she looked as though, if someone put their hand in the wrong place, she'd happily cosh them over the head with one of the mugs at her disposal. "Another gin for myself and my friend, lass," Darby said, slipping her a coin. "Keep the coin coming, my lord, and the gin will flow all night." She tucked the coin between her bosom, then rushed off through the thick crowd, easily dancing around men who tried to grab her, and two of those men began to shout at each other. As James pulled his gaze from the fight, something caught his attention across the room. The flourish of a rose-coloured cloak and the stiffened stance of a young woman. Darby tossed back another drink of gin. "I told you this was just the place." He nodded, only half-listening. The girl was arguing passionately with an older woman. No, she was not a girl. She was a woman, but she was slight, as if she did not eat nearly enough. Her soft blonde hair was coiled atop her head. Her cloak was ratty about her frame, and she was arguing most intensely. But the older woman, whose hair was curled and powdered white, kept shaking her head. Her gnarled hands went to her hips, and then she had what seemed to be the temerity to reach up and tweak the other woman on the chin. The young woman pulled back, and then the older woman swung away and marched off, her white hair flapping about her face, and in her place stood a large brute who stared down at the young lady as if he was either going to crush her into the floor or drag her into the hallway and show her what a brute he was. It wasn't something James would tolerate. This woman was bold, he could tell that,
but he could not bear to see her suffer as so many women did. Perhaps it was her spark, and he knew how easy it was to snuff such a thing out. James took a swallow of gin, then banged the glass down on the table and stood. "I'll be right back." Darby grew quiet, then ground out, "If you want to keep your teeth, sit down." But he would not. Doing this would at least give him a moment's peace, a moment's respite from the memories that had been crashing in on him of late, and from the fact that he was in London, a place he loathed and could not wait to tear down. He crossed the room easily, eyes locked on his target. He was a captain, and captains were supposed to have cool heads, but he could not bear when the strong preyed on the weak. James prided himself in the fact that he rose to the defence of others quickly, because nothing got past him. No injustice, no cruelty. He'd crush it before it could crush them. Chapter 2. How had all her ambition come to this? Lily's hands curled into fists. She hid them in the folds of her worn skirts as she stood arguing with Mother Maggie. Mother Maggie, indeed. Such a name made the woman standing across from her sound as benign as a mother hen. Mother Maggie was as vicious as a she-wolf and would happily sink her rotting teeth into Lily's back haunches and tear a piece out of them. "I promise I will get you the rest of the funds," Lily said, her heart hammering. Waves of panic rose up in her, and it was all she could do to stay composed. But she refused to let the old woman see her fear. Mother Maggie rolled her yellowed eyes, eyes which had no doubt seen too much wine over the years, but the old woman was as sharp as a tack.
"Jill," she lilted in surprisingly plummy tones, "I loaned you a sum of £10, and you have not repaid me as you said you would."
"I know," Lily licked her dry lips, "but it has been most difficult. I am not getting as much work as I thought I would. You see, I am not allowed to do any extra jobs outside of Madame's shop, and..."
"I am not interested in your excuses," Mother Maggie snapped.
Then her rouged lips parted in a deceptively sweet grin.
"My dear, the only way for you to achieve your dreams is to get a protector, and I know many of those. I would happily arrange a meeting with someone for you."
"I am not interested in that line of work." Lily's stomach coiled at the thought of taking up the oldest trade.
"My goodness,"
Mother Maggie clucked, all sweetness still, even as her eyes flashed.
"High and mighty, aren't we?"
But then her smile dimmed and she leaned forward, the scent of rose perfume wafting around her, drifting out from her green silk gown.
"I own you, Jill, from the top of your head to the tips of your toes, and the piece between."
She clapped her hands together, causing her rings to wink in the glow of the lamps.
"So, you need to understand that if I decide that you do that kind of work, you will."
Lily held back a groan of frustration. She was supposed to be standing on her own two feet. She was supposed to be protecting her sister Violet, and all she'd had was one dream, a dress shop of her own, where she could sell her original designs. She had been working toward it for a decade now, but between the madame of the dress shop, who worked her hands to the bone all hours of the day and night, and now Mother Maggie, to whom she owed money, her dreams were slipping away faster than sand through a glass. Lily willed herself to stand strong. She had seen the hell of Paris in 1789, and then she'd seen regimes change and an empire rise where her parents had chosen the wrong side. She'd found herself returned to London with no one to look after herself and Violet, and the knowledge that being on the wrong side meant death. Her grandfather was a duke and had refused to help, no matter how she begged, and now she could not bear to ask for charity from anyone. But, owing a debt, she realised, too late, was no better. "I only ask for a little bit more time to get the money that you require," she rushed to explain.
I will be able to do so once I... Mother Maggie laughed, then wiped her eyes as if terribly amused, before she propped her hands on her padded hips.
I have heard that so many times. It never turns out to be true.
It had to be true. She'd been so certain she could get the money. So certain. The older woman pursed her lips.
I shall give you extra time to repay me, but I'll start adding interest to it as well. The longer it takes you to get the coin, the more you owe.
Her frighteningly convincing kind smile returned, and she pinched Lily's chin.
Now, I shall make certain that John takes you home. One wouldn't want anything to happen to you. Now, would they?
No, she replied, fighting the tightness in her throat. And with that, Mother Maggie turned on her painted red heel and headed into the thick crowd. John, who was Maggie's favourite tough, stepped forward. He was a big, broad-shouldered fellow who made Lily's skin crawl, but at least she wouldn't get in any trouble at this hour of night if he walked her home. He gave her a quick look up and down, his lips parting lasciviously.
"Hello, darling,"
he said, his ham-like arms straining his poorly cut coat.
"Seems like you've upset my mistress. You know, you really should do whatever you can to please her, else she'll make your life quite rough in the future."
"I have no interest in pleasing your mistress," she returned, though she did not doubt him. "I only wish to pay her back."
"Then you're a silly piece," he said.
"I am not," she countered. "A dreamer, perhaps. Hopeful, perhaps."
"That makes you a right silly piece."
He grabbed her arm.
"Come on, then. Let's go."
A fist shot out of nowhere, cracked against John's cheek, and sent him hurtling backward. Lily let out a cry of shock before she spotted her would-be rescuer, a giant of a fellow with long, dark hair cascading over his broad shoulders, launched himself onto John. His black coat, embroidered with silver leaves and lined with silver buttons, swung about his powerful frame as he tackled the tough as if he were nothing but an irritating fly. No, this was a disaster. She was already in trouble with Mother Maggie, and if this man assaulted John on her behalf, she could not imagine how much worse things would get for her. She darted forward, ready to grab him from behind, but then another pair of hands shot out and seized hold of her.
"Step aside, miss,"
a polished voice said in low but cheerful rumbles.
"We'll take care of him for you."
"I don't want you to take care of him," she bellowed, kicking and trying to wrestle free.
"What? Why?"
"He's not bothering me," she gritted out.
"He clearly is bothering you," he said with amusement. "Or rather he was, and James is going to make sure he never does that again."
Good God, they were going to ruin her life rescuing her. She tried again to free herself of his grasp, and again she failed. "Please make him stop."
"No one can make the American stop once he's started, miss, or so I've found."
"American? Well, perhaps I can," she retorted. She elbowed the man, and he let out a startled whoosh of air, loosening his grip. Lily darted forward. "Cease this at once!" In all her life, she'd never seen anyone attack one of Mother Maggie's men. It was the most harrowing thing she'd ever witnessed. Then, suddenly, the man named James stopped and swung around to face her. He arched a single dark brow, looking completely, wickedly alive. His cheekbones were two slashes, his jaw a hard square, and his eyes danced as if this brawl was the most thrilling thing he'd ever done. She doubted it, though. She had a terrible feeling he was accustomed to such moments. His wide, broad chest pumped up and down, straining his linen shirt. It was well tailored, and he was a magnificent specimen. His breeches clung to hard, tree-trunk-like legs, and he took a step toward her. John lay prostrate on the floor, groaning, not dead or knocked out, but wise enough not to try standing. James gave her a slow smile.
"He won't bother you again, miss."
"You are the one bothering me," she ground out. His wicked gaze dazzled, but a strange look furrowed his brow.
"You're not pleased by what I've done?" he stated.
"Oh, look," she mocked, barely able to contain her frustration. "You can listen. Well done," she said, applauding slowly. His smile dimmed.
"I protected you."
"Your protection has made my life worse," she groaned. His gaze narrowed as he asked in that frustratingly compelling, brandy-warm voice,
"How in God's name could pounding this fellow into the ground make your life worse?"
"Because you will leave this place tonight," she explained through gritted teeth. "You are an American, as your friend and your accent make clear, and you live nowhere near here, as your clothing and general demeanour have made clear. Whereas I live in this part of town, and I shall have to deal with this man's fury and his employer's fury every day." He paused at that. She sucked in a breath, feeling horrifically conflicted. All she wanted was to get home to Violet now, sink into her bed, and pray that an answer to all her problems would come to her. Or better yet, those problems would solve themselves by morning. "Now, good evening to you, sir. Do not follow." And with that, she whirled on her heel and started for the door, ready to forget this night. But the images kept flashing through her head. The massive, beautiful giant of a man, eyes flashing, driving John into the ground. How she longed to love it. She wished she could. John deserved it. He'd made many a young woman's life hell. But she couldn't stop the rising panic and dread. She was going to have to do so much work to fix the damage that American had caused. She didn't even know where to begin. With Mother Maggie? Marvellous. More interest, no doubt. Or the doctor's bill? Oh, dear heaven! The very idea sent a chill through her veins. She muttered to herself as she headed out into the street, weaving through the tightly packed web of London's rabbit warrens. Drunks staggered everywhere, some clutching bottles, but most of them had already consumed the portion of alcohol that they could afford for the night, and were waiting merely to go to sleep from it. Others laughed and sang at the top of their lungs, and some danced and sold hot soup, punch, and every possible used item one could imagine. She quickly averted her eyes from anyone exchanging the skin trade in the alleyways. It was one of the riskier parts of this side of town, seeing the strangest things at this hour of night, but it wasn't exactly as if street girls had offices. Most shared rooms with dozens of others to make ends meet. They had to sell their wares where they could, and just as she was about to turn down another alley, praying it was empty, a hand reached out and grabbed her. She let out a scream, whirled around, and brought up her knee, as she'd learned how to do, and stomped down hard upon the man's foot. He let out a muffled grunt of dismay and tensed against her, but he let go of her immediately.
"Hell's bells, woman," he bit out. "You're good at that."
She was tempted to dart off, but she realized it was the same big man as before, that devil who had gazed at her and looked so pleased with himself. "You're following me," she said. "I told you not to."
"I owe you an apology," he said.
She squared her shoulders, but refused to believe that all he wished was to apologize.
"You'd make an excellent captain of a ship if given half the chance."
His smile, his heart-wrenchingly beautiful smile, lit his eyes with charm.
"Are you looking for a job?"
he teased.
"No," she said.
"I am looking to repay that man's employer, and you've now likely added to my debt."
"What?"
he asked.
"How?"
"I owe the woman I was speaking to money, and he's her hired tough. No doubt you thought that you could step in and solve it all with your fists?" He let out a sigh.
"I did, rather."
She folded her arms under her breasts, the chill air stealing through her thin cloak. "Is everything so simple where you're from that you just solve things with your fists?"
"No,"
he said honestly. "But fists do often come in handy, especially with men like that." She did not doubt it. "Well, you misread the
Sample complete. Ready to continue?